Have you heard of the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Well, you will this hour, and we will ask you, if it's enacted, whether it will be a good or bad thing for the U.S. in today's Big Question. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, November 6th. Every Wednesday at this time, we pick an issue facing the state, the nation, or the world, and we find a guest or guests to discuss it with us and ask you to join in with your questions and your views. At the end of this hour, we will give you a chance to sound off on the big question, and you can vote in our online poll at WPR.org. Today, because of listener suggestions, including one yesterday during our open line, we decided to pick the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement as our big question topic. The TTP is the largest free trade agreement yet, involving the United States and 11 Asian and Pacific nations. It would account for 40% of world trade. It's on track to take effect by the end of the year, yet it really isn't getting much attention, probably due to other issues in the news. Here is your chance to learn more about it and to ask about it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Mireya Solis, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Center for East Asia Policy Studies and as Associate Professor in the School of International Service at American University. Her areas of expertise include political economy, foreign policy, and government-business relations. Good morning, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be in your program.
Now, we did have some listeners suggest we do something on this Trans-Pacific Partnership, saying that this is like the biggest trade deal ever and no one really knows about it. So what is TTP? TPP.
Thank you so much, Joy. So TPP is certainly a big deal. It is the most ambitious trade initiative pursued by the Obama administration, one that will have large ramifications for overall trade policy and the direction of the world trading system. So I think what is important for your listeners to understand is that the TPP stands out for many different reasons. We have hundreds of trade agreements that have been notified to the World Trade Organization, but none has come close to the level of ambition of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Currently, it comprises 12 countries that represent close to 40% of world GDP, as you were commenting before. But I think what's really striking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that, first of all, it aims to create an Asia-Pacific platform for integration. So we're trying to avoid a world of divided, self-contained regions. The world actually has crisscrossing economic relations, and Asia is the most dynamic region in the world, and therefore the United States has a core interest in being part and parcel of that growth dynamo. So that's one first reason why the TPP stands out. But second, It comes with an unprecedented level of ambition, because other trade agreements in the past have been much easier to negotiate because governments agreed to set aside the sensitive sectors. And then you end up negotiating trade agreements that are actually of low quality. The mantra of the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been no exclusions. We don't know if this will actually be upheld at the end of the negotiations, but most likely the liberalization ratio will be incredibly high, in the order of 98% or so. And finally, the Trans-Pacific Partnership stands out because of the very ambitious agenda regarding the non-tariff barriers. We should all know that tariffs are old news. They have been brought down because of the successful efforts of the World Trade Organization. And now we're dealing in a much more complex world where the barriers that hinder market access are so-called non-tariff barriers, which means that all kinds of regulations, for example, that are put in place to try to hamper access by foreign products or foreign companies are there, but, you know, they're hard to quantify, hard to measure, and sometimes not clear if they're there to satisfy, to meet genuine social public purposes, or they're there to hinder the access by foreign companies and foreign products.
Well, it's very ambitious. If we could boil it down, proponents of the Trans-Pacific Partnership would say that the whole point, the goal of this is to what?
Well, I think that opponents have a number of arguments they bring up.
I mean, proponents, the people who are in favor. Yeah. Why do proponents want this? What is the goal of doing this?
Because we want growth. We want to improve the standard of living of all the participating economies. And because, quite unfortunately, the World Trade Organization has reached negotiation deadlock. And this means that we do not have a good vehicle to move forward the trade agenda in a way in which it actually represents the realities of global production and trade. So the idea is that there will be income gains, there would be gains from trade, there would be efficiency benefits, and that's all very important in terms of revitalizing economies. This can also be done, and is important, without having to resort to heavy government spending. This is off-budget sources of growth. And I think it's also important because there are larger geostrategic political gains to be made by asserting American influence in the region, by the United States actually being an architect of the rules that will define the patterns of integration in the most dynamic region in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, this involves 12 countries, including the United States, but it does not involve China.
Not yet. I think that, you know, the idea behind the TPP is that you first assemble a critical mass of like-minded countries, countries that agree to these very high standards and are prepared to go forward. But it is an expansive project. In principle, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is open to all APEC economies, all member economies of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. That represents 21 countries, and China is one of them. So in principle, China could request membership in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. China has not decided to do so yet. I think that it's clear that this would have to be a longer-term proposition for China. China is waiting to see what is actually negotiated in the TPP. But I think what has been encouraging, Joy, is that in the beginning, China took a much more guarded view of the TPP, and you could hear frequently commentators from China making the case that this could be some form of containment of China, trying to isolate and marginalize China. But I think that now, China, these commentators, their voices are not as actively heard. And I think there's been a change of views. And I think that China is now making a signaling that it's actually starting the TPP, and that perhaps in the future it could anticipate joining if it considers that it's central in order to advance its market reforms.
When Japan joined the TPP, you said in an interview that the economic gains that the United States can expect from the partnership could triple. How do you figure that?
Well, this has to do with a study that economists have done. This is a study by Professor Petri and his colleagues that was published by the Peterson Institute of International Economics. And basically what they do is a statistical econometric study that looks at the income gains and the export gains. And therefore, they estimate how much would export rise, how much would these investment flows would increase, how much these would also generate not only static benefits, but dynamic benefits in terms of increased efficiency, productivity, larger economies of scale. And they all then arrived at this conclusion. And I think it's very important to understand that Japan joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a huge boost to these trade grouping. First of all, because it consolidated its credentials as a genuine Asia-Pacific endeavor, because now you have one of the largest Asian economies on board, but also for the United States because it does not have yet a free trade agreement with Japan. And we know that the United States has tried over the years to open the Japanese market, and this is the first time that the Japanese government is willing to go so far in terms of agricultural liberalization, in terms of eliminating regulations that hamper access. And therefore, you're talking about additional fresh gains from trade because this is indeed an unprecedented negotiation effort. Also because Japan and the United States, in addition to the TPP negotiations, decided to launch at the same time a parallel bilateral effort that will actually look even deeper into the non-tariff barriers.
We are talking about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. It's poised to take effect by the end of the year. We'll talk a little bit more about that process as well in just a moment. We are talking with a guest international trade expert about the goals of the TPP, and we'll talk some about the criticisms that some have that the agreement is a big corporate power grab. Plus, we invite you to weigh in, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is The Big Question on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. In today's Big Question, a comprehensive free trade deal involving the United States and 11 Asian and Pacific nations is on track to take effect by the end of 2013. If enacted, will the Trans-Pacific Partnership be good or bad for the United States? That is today's big question. You can find it online at WPR.org and vote online. You can also join us for our discussion right now at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We're inviting your questions and points for our guest. We will allow you an opportunity to sound off at the end of this hour. We are happy to have with us our guest, Mireya Solis, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Center for East Asia Policy Studies. She's also an Associate Professor in the School of International Service at American University. She's telling us the goals of the TPP, and we'll talk a little bit about the criticism, though I see we have many callers who have criticisms. Let me, Ian on Facebook says, this just opens it up for more poor people to be exploited for working 12 hours a day for a $1 paycheck. Sweatshops becoming trendy again. Can you talk a little bit about worker protections under the TPP?
Yes, of course, Joy. You know, it has been a traditional argument of people who are very skeptical of free trade agreements, and they portray this as a race to the bottom, where, you know, it would be a multinational corporate expansion that would be driven by the search for the lowest possible paid worker, and there would be absolutely no safeguards. And I think that the evidence is quite strong and robust that shows that actually this is not a fear that we should be concerned that it will actually materialize. For one reason, because one of the hallmarks of the U.S. trade agreements is the insistence that there have to be labor standards in place. And over time, actually, these labor standards incorporated in trade agreements have increased. And I think that we all expect that these labor standards will be indeed included in the TPP, and therefore that this shouldn't result in the further exploitation of workers. On the contrary, the expectation and why these governments of all these 12 countries are joining the negotiation is because they do expect this to generate growth, and therefore this should improve the standard of living of participating economies. They would not do this if they would be contemplating actually harm done to workers of participating economies.
John in Madison is with us now. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question or point?
So my question is if we've ever seen any trade agreement really increase the middle class in America and their wages. I know after the creation of NAFTA, our GDP grew in the United States, but we also saw downward pressure on wages in the middle class. And I wonder if, you know, trade agreement with Europe, where they already have higher labor standards and labor laws, might be more beneficial than opening up markets in Asia.
All right. So will this help the working middle class in America?
it should help to the extent that it helps promote efficiency, and therefore it helps to have larger productivity, and we know that wages should reflect the productivity increases. I think it's important to realize, of course, that we should not think that trade agreements have these tremendous repercussions in an economy as large as the United States, and one that is not as heavily dependent on foreign trade as other smaller economies. So I think that frequently we tend to get bogged down in discussion about trade agreements on the jobs issue. And the fears rise that this is going to produce, you know, we heard it at the time of NAFTA, this big sucking sound which never materialized. So I don't think we should, you know, think of these trade agreements mostly as to whether they're going to destroy jobs. We have seen that they have not. And they probably will have a modest effect in terms of job creation. But what's more important is what happens to the quality of those jobs. And I think that we can see, therefore, that there would be this improvement if this becomes a source for greater efficiency for these internationally competitive sectors of the American economy to gain a level playing field, and therefore they can generate better, higher quality jobs within the United States. So I think that, you know, the agreement with Europe that John brought up is also a very important initiative, and I think that there are expected gains from both trade agreements, but I think also we have to understand that the TPP has been the precursor of what we now call these mega trade agreements. So now the United States has trade agreements with Asia-Pacific economies and with the transatlantic economies. And I think what happens in the TPP, because it was launched first, in terms of whether these very high levels of ambition can be realized, will have a very large impact on the hopefully successful evolution of those transatlantic negotiations as well.
You say that the big sucking sound did not materialize of mm-hmm. jobs being lost, but at least anecdotally, we hear all, you know, that a lot of jobs were sent overseas or to Mexico or somewhere else, instead of that we lost a lot of manufacturing jobs in this country because manufacturers could do it cheaper elsewhere.
It is true that if you look at specific instances and anecdotes, of course, you know, there are always some losers from trade liberalization. When we talk about the overall efficiency gains, productivity gains, export, greater export potential, we're looking at the overall economy effects. We do have to understand that trade liberalization does bring about winners and losers, just as technological change does. And we do not think that we should therefore stop technological change. On the contrary, we see that this creates an opportunity for greater efficiency, but that we should in fact devise social safety networks so that we do not leave those disadvantaged workers without any assistance, without any help, without the ability to engage in some kind of retraining and retooling. So I think that obviously we have to be quite explicit in, you know, of course, accepting that there's going to be some sectors that will have a harder time keeping up with international competition. But holding on and trying to protect these sectors and therefore deny the other growth opportunities to the other parts of the economy is actually counterproductive and unsustainable. The better path is to look for ways to have a more efficient, more flexible economy that will allocate resources more efficiently, and to also have targeted interventions to make sure that wherever there's going to be a trade adjustment burden, that the needs of those communities and those workers can be met.
Let's take George in Rosendale next. Hello, George.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Your guest is completely wrong. If we have a free trade agreement in the Trans-Pacific area, New Zealand will be able to export 100% of their dairy products into the United States, wiping out 10 to 15% of the dairy farmers in the United States, and most of them in Wisconsin, Minnesota, because cheese would be their main export item.
Oh.
Plus the jobs in Indonesia now pay, after a strike, pay $210 per month. The amount of inefficiency she's trying to imply that we have in the United States is simply that we're trying to hang on to, in the United States, a working class population so that they can live and pay taxes, as well as the small businesses that support them.
George, thank you so much. I mean, we have just a minute and a half or so before a news break, and that specific example, especially applicable to America's dairy land, New Zealand will be able to export a bunch of dairy, and that's going to put a lot of farmers out of work here in Wisconsin?
Well, that outcome has not been decided, Joy, actually, because the United States has, has adopted a position whereby it's trying to perhaps not open completely some sectors that have not yet been put for complete tariff liberalization. Sugar is one. There we don't know yet what's going to be the final outcome. And even if there is an agreement to open the market, this would be phased in liberalization commitments. And the idea is that they would not be all of a sudden a blow, but a time to adjust and time to deal better with that sort of international competition. So again, for some sectors, indeed, this may present some very difficult challenges, and I appreciate, George's point of view, which is different from what I've been endorsing. And, trade policy does generate these very heated debates, and certainly there will be some sectors that will be facing growing international competition, but it's not clear yet what's going to be the final outcome on dairy. And we also have to look at the overall economy and how other sectors would actually do better by having greater access to international markets.
We're going to check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will continue talking about the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. Would the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement be good or bad for the U.S.? That's today's big question. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Wednesday, November 6th. We are talking with an international trade expert about the goals of the TPP and the criticisms that some have. Proponents say it would be good to revitalize economies. Opponents say that it would be a big corporate power grab. We welcome your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We also invite you to go to wpr.org/joy and vote in our online poll. Our guest is Mireya Solis, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Center for East Asia Policy Studies, an associate professor in the School of International Service at American University. Her areas of expertise include political economy, foreign policy, and government-business relations. And before we go back to the phones, Mireya, let's talk a little bit about process in terms of where we are in terms of the negotiations. President Obama was planning on attending a regional summit on the TPP a few weeks back, but then did not go because of the government shutdown. How significant was that meeting, and did that push back this agreement? Again, I forgot. I'll have to ask you to start over. I had the wrong button pushed, so go ahead.
Oh, sure. I think it was definitely unfortunate that President Obama could not attend the Bali Summit and the East Asia Summit because of the government shutdown. And it is unfortunate because, it increases concerns in the region about the sustaining power of the United States in the region. And I think it's been very important to reassure them that the United States is fully committed and can be present in these very important regional summits. Now, I don't think that the harm is permanent, and I think that, everybody understands that the president had very good reasons for not attending. Nevertheless, it did slow down the process of negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership because we understand that we are now in the final critical stage where these agreements that negotiators cannot bridge at the negotiation table have to be brought up to the attention of the leaders so that they can actually make those political decisions and try to bridge those negotiation gaps. Because President Obama was not there, then it was harder for this high-level process of consensus-building, consultation, deal-making to take place. Now, I think it's important also to take into account that the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been under negotiation for now 3 years, and the idea is that you do want to bring some finality to the process The concern is that the longer this drags on, that it's harder for the government to sustain the level of attention, the commitment of all the resources that go into these negotiations. And the concern also is that this could send a message of a possible negotiation drift. And nobody would like, say, a Doha round phenomena to unfold in a Trans-Pacific Partnership where it's not possible to bring a consensus and the negotiations linger on. There's an important consideration in terms of the electoral calendar in the United States because of the midterm elections next year, and it would be ideal to try to wrap up these negotiations before even the electoral calendar begins to then affect these, this process. So the question is, though, can the negotiations be really finalized the way in which the American government and the USTR has insisted that they should by the end of this year? There are different views. I tend to be more skeptical that given that this can be accomplished, given the very outstanding sizable disagreements on core areas of the agreement, such as rules for intellectual property, rules for state-owned enterprises, and the fact that the market access negotiations have not yet been finalized, and there's still very sensitive negotiations, for example, with Japan regarding agricultural opening. So it seems to me unlikely that this can be done by the end of the year, and most likely this will bring us to next spring. And this ties in with another very important process that needs to take place within the United States, and that is the adoption of trade promotion authority, that the Congress would vote to give the president trade promotion authority, because Congress has been so preoccupied by the budget battles, this process has not moved fast enough, and this actually also influences the evolution of the TPP negotiation.
And that that authority, is that what's known as fast track?
That's right.
And that's going to probably happen in the spring, as far as you can tell?
Well, the TPP negotiations most likely will be done by the spring. When will fast track or trade promotion authority be passed? It's everyone's guess. We had heard that this conversation, that the draft of a bill would actually speed up over the summer. That did not happen. There is now, you know, discussion as to the, you know, the relevant committees in Congress are considering the legislative language that they would use for these fast-track bill. But the fact is that we do not have yet anything very concrete. The process has not advanced very quickly, so it is not. It's very unclear when will this actually be ready.
Yeah, we had a former longtime labor leader and guest on this program here in Wisconsin, David Newby, formerly of the AFL-CIO of Wisconsin, was very concerned about the fast track coming up. But he also wrote a piece about how the Madison Common Council passed a resolution opposing the TPP. He said the deal would outlaw by American laws and ordinances and give foreign corporations the rights to sue governments if they passed regulations that reduced their expected profits. Is he right? Would the TPP do those things?
Not exactly. Certainly, I think that the claims are exaggerated. First of all, the problem with the Buy American clause is that, you know, these trade agreements have government procurement chapters, and the idea is that you want to have level playing field. And the idea is that, you know, many countries object to these clauses that give a preference to American suppliers. And they have brought this to the negotiations. But we have to also take into account the benefits that American companies would obtain by having greater access to the government procurement markets in many of these countries. We also have to take into account the huge benefits that would come about with a high-quality disciplines and state-owned enterprises that would indeed level the playing field in countries like Vietnam for American companies, given that the state-owned sector in Vietnam is so large. Now, the other issue that you brought up has generated a lot of controversy, and this is the so-called investor-state dispute settlement mechanism. And the idea here is, of course, that the World Trade Organization does have a dispute settlement mechanism where governments who deem that other WTO countries have breached the commitments of the WTO can initiate a legal proceeding. But at the WTO, it's only governments who have legal standing. What's different in many of these free trade agreements, and let's clarify that the TPP is not the first, that the United States has plenty, many of these trade agreements and bilateral investment treaties that do have this kind of investor-state dispute settlement mechanism, is that corporations have legal standing. And what this means is that they could initiate a proceeding when they make the case that a government is in breach of the commitments undertaken through that specific trade agreement. Now, there has been a lot of controversy about this clause in particular, and I think what is important is to see what is the language, what are the conditions that are introduced in this investor-state dispute settlement, because you can introduce important safeguards to make sure that the ability of the government to regulate on environmental standards is not surrendered and that cannot be challenged by corporations through these legal proceedings. And I think that for those people who are very skeptical and who, you know, try to portray the TPP as, you know, given unriddled power to these corporations, they should realize that the language can be crafted in a way in which the regulatory capacity of government is maintained, but also that there are many other trade agreements and investment treaties that have had these similar rules, and we do not see an avalanche of cases that have, you know, rendered the ability of government to regulate moot.
Jan in Eau Claire is with us now. Hi, Jan.
Hello. It was very interesting that you bring this up, because on Sunday, Bill Moyers had a program with two guests on that really enlightened us a lot. They said this agreement was done in secret, and they couldn't access the whole agreement. It's written by corporations for corporations, and your guest just said that something about the laws, and it wouldn't supersede our environmental laws. The guests on Bill Moyers' show said, yes, that indeed would supersede our laws, and we could have no power to change that. And it was very interesting that NAFTA was portrayed, as your guest is portraying this, in a very good light and a very fair light. But as we know, the results of NAFTA resulted in so many of our jobs leaving the United States. So I hope that the public would really have an opportunity to hear the other side of the story, and perhaps you can tell it by having on one or the other of the guests that were on the Bill Moyers show. And yeah, we really appreciate your airing this today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan. So what about charge that this deal is being negotiated in secret and it's being written by corporations for corporations?
Yes, that's also a concern that has been raised by different people over time. And, you know, I don't think that the TPP is particularly secretive compared to the process of other trade negotiations. The argument that trade negotiators make is that because they are in the process of exchanging offers for market access, for rules on international trade and investment, they cannot disclose when the negotiation is ongoing what is taking place. But there are safeguards in place, and there are notification procedures whereby these trade negotiators have the obligation to brief people in Congress. And, you know, we know that there is no Trade Promotion Authority currently in place, but the approach that the USTR has followed from the beginning has been to follow the requirements of Trade Promotion Authority as if it were in place. And there are notification requirements. There are information sessions. The United States also has a very large system of stakeholders who participate in briefings and have the opportunity to give input. So it is, you know, it is true that even for people like me that write about trade, of course we would like to get more of the day-to-day exchange of offers. We would like to know everything that's taking place. But the idea is that this would actually be harmful to the negotiations. And there are other mechanisms in which you make sure that some of this information does reach Congress, for instance. Having said that, we should also keep in mind that the trade agreement is not going to be voted without a good public airing. And that is, once the agreement is ready, the entire content of the agreement will be published. It can be read by everyone. And before Congress votes, the entire contents of it will be discussed and assessed. So there will be an opportunity for, at that point, see whether this is a good deal or not, and people can then make more informed decisions based on everything now being disclosed.
Yeah, fair enough. Here's a question from Ken, an email. He says trade agreements should benefit the U.S. What exports would increase under this agreement?
Well, everything that has to do with the areas of international competitiveness of the American economy. So we know the United States has a lead in services. We know that services now represent a much larger share of the world economy and world trade. So the United States has a lead in anything that has, you know, strong value-added, strong intellectual property content to it. So those are areas where definitely the United States will benefit. And, manufacturing would also probably benefit. So the idea is that you would only have to perhaps go through those sectors that have a strong international presence and where Asia is a growth economy and therefore they could indeed do well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess in conclusion, maybe I'll have you react to Peter on Facebook, who says the sooner we raise the third world out of poverty, the better off everyone will be. In essence, I think saying that this would be good for the world is that fair? Is this going to be good for the world?
I think it is going to be good for the world, Joy. I mean, again, if you look at those estimates of the income gains, there are going to be very sizable global gains in terms of increased income. For example, this Petri study that I was citing for estimates that by the year 2025, global benefits, that is not only for participating TPP countries, but countries that would benefit from the increased growth and exchange and trade, we'd reach something like $223 billion per year. We also know that, you know, for the most part, countries that follow policies of openness and try to increase competition and efficiency do better. Now, we also have to make sure that it is not enough to just say trade is good, these trade agreements are good, without looking at what's the actual content of these trade agreements. That's why we have to be so mindful to make sure that we get high-quality agreements and agreements that also serve the benefits, serve the interest of developing countries.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Joy.
Mireya Solis is a senior fellow at the Brookings Center for East Asia Policy Studies, associate professor at American University. Well, now it's up to you to tell us, what do you think so far? We don't know all of the content of this trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. But our big question is, will this be good for the U.S. or not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Your turn to sound off here on the Ideas Network. A comprehensive free trade deal involving the United States and 11 Asian and Pacific nations is on track to take effect by the end of 2013. At least that's what has been believed. If enacted, will the Trans-Pacific Partnership be good or bad for the U.S.? That is today's big question, and you can sound off by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You think it would be good or bad, or are you not sure? Our first caller is Carla in La Crosse. Hi, Carla.
I wondered, you know, if the taxpayers would be holding, you know, the bag if they were sued, if we were sued, you know, under some kind of trade agreement, because the taxpayers end up suffering the cost of damage to our land, extracted minerals, and other losses that we would have to take on while they're making all the money. And I also wanted to say that the free trade agreement seemed to cause a greater income disparity. So that's all I wanted to know.
Thank you very much, Carla. Let's go to Larry in Middleton. What do you think, Larry?
Well, I'm opposed to the TPP. It has relatively little to do with trade. It's basically an anti-sovereignty agreement, or as some have said, it's basically a corporate bill of rights. Much of my concern is over the so-called investor-state provisions, which would mean that after the treaty would be enacted, if the United States would enact a law, let's say, to protect the public health, say, from a cancerous hazard, if that violates the TPP, then if there's a foreign corporation that would lose profits because of this new law, that corporation can sue for lost profits.
Thank you very much, Larry. We have limited time during the sound offs. And going next to Ray in Stevens Point. Hi, Ray.
I'm opposed to these trade agreements because, in practice, we've seen that the income gains that they claim to deliver are all kept within the boardrooms of corporations at the expense of middle class wages. A good example is in Appleton, where Kimberly Clark, in their offer to their employees last month, cited their new paper mills they have built overseas as the reason that they need to cut wages for their American workers.
Thank you very much, Ray. Kevin in Bellevue, Iowa. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Joy. I guess I would resoundingly agree with the former callers. Without repeating anything, I'm against the treaty agreement, too. It seems so shrouded. If it's been on the board for 3 years to be discussed, we've heard so little about this, and it appears that many stakeholders are not at the table to really craft this. So even when she has great access, supposedly, to information, but says over and over again she would like to have much more, just imagine what the taxpayers are really or the general public are quite lost in this. So I would agree to encourage you to have one of Bill Moyer's guests to visit with us.
Thank you very much. Bill in Kenosha. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I agree. Ray was absolutely right on the mark. Productivity gains have been tremendous in this country for the last 30 years, and none of it is filtered down to the worker. I'm against any of these type of help the rest of the world policies.
Thank you very much. We're going to get one last sound-off caller in. Jean, go ahead.
Hi. I'm against this agreement. I think corporations already have too much power, and it does not benefit the people of our country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jean. You can continue to vote in our Big Question online poll. It's at WPR.org/joy. You can vote whether or not you think the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be good or bad for the United States. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. By the way, so far, 79% of you are against the TPP. You think it will be bad for this country. We'll be right back.